Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
Hello, I'm Taylor, the communication doctor, and welcome to Real Stories. I just want to say, I come from a family where people didn't always speak their truth. And I think it's so important to speak their truth. And every day I meet people who, because of society, are just walking with that facade because they feel that it is the way to be. And in Real Stories, I want people to know the real story behind the facade. And that is why I do what I do.
Hi, this is Real Stories, and I am your host, Tanya the Communication Doctor. And today on my show, I have Helen Barnett, and Helen is a mental health advocate. Welcome, Helen.
Hi, Tanya. It's lovely to meet you.
It's lovely to meet you. And I just want to say, I'm really excited to have you on my show today. And people may say, God, you say it about everyone, Tanya, but I'm really excited because I've read a little bit about your story, and when you've approached me, I was just blown away by it. And I feel that my audience will be blown away by it too, because you have just so much strength. So I'm really excited to share this with you. So my first question is, why are you a mental health advocate?
Well, thanks for having me. And it's just lovely to share my story. I mean, it's come about really being a mental health advocate in the last sort of 10 months, really, so fairly recently. But my story sort of began a long time ago, and I've just recently been sort of encouraged to speak out and share my story, that sort of, if that makes sense, because I'd lived with it for so long. And I've been helped by a group of military veterans, really, to speak out, and that's happened in 12 months, really.
Oh, wow. So, you know, you just mentioned you've been helped by a military veteran. So let's just, before we go into the military, because I'm aware that you're in the military, let's just go back to you as a child, actually, because it'd be quite nice to get a whole feel of your story. So what was your most fondest memory of being a child?
I was really lucky, and I know a lot of people aren't as fortunate as me, but I had a really, really lovely childhood, and I grew up in a little village, and my parents were market gardeners, and I just have really fond memories of just being happy and secure, and, you know, really, the older I get, the more I do appreciate, you know, what my parents and sort of extended families really. And I think that real sort of strong sense of core and belonging helped me through some of my most difficult times, to be honest, Tanya.
Yeah. No, it sounds like it. And what's so lovely is you've got such a great foundation to start from. But what I find quite interesting is, you know, coming from the family you did, and I know you said you grew up in a village in the Cotswolds, and anybody doesn't know, it's absolutely beautiful in the Cotswolds. It's quite, I would call it one of the most beautiful places in this country to grow up in England. And what led you to get involved with the military? What inspired you to do that?
Yeah, well, it was actually the police that I joined. And it was, well, my parents were third generation market gardeners in the village that I came from. And I think they could see how the future was going to go, that small little family run businesses like they were, weren't going to be able to survive. And they just didn't want me and my brother to sort of go down that route, that career choice. So it was, you know, just really sort of being pushed out of the nest, really. And I was very, very sporty as a child. And I guess probably I took everything for granted at home. I think it was just sort of normal, and I wanted to sort of go and you know, sort of fly the nest, as it were, and do you know, something different to what my sort of family and the generations before had done, really.
Yeah, and that's really kind of powerful and courageous of you. So when you joined the police, what was your role?
Yes, so I left our village when I was 18, and I joined. I was a police cadet in the Met, which was a year of just fantastic opportunities, adventure training, sport, service within the community, helping at different sort of centres within London. So it was just a combination of all that kind of thing, which was just absolutely marvellous experience, really. You know, really character building, some of the things, you know, that we did, and a really fantastic foundation. And once I'd completed that year, I went on to Hendon Police Training College and completed my sort of training as a police constable, and then was out, you know, at the police station in North London in the beginning, sort of long time ago now, 1986.
Now, what I find really interesting, you know, being a police officer, and you know, you like you said, you had your training in Hendon and you were working in North London. I always wonder what was the most horrific thing that you ever experienced as a police officer?
Oh my goodness. Gosh, yeah, a lot of things really. Bearing in mind I was just 19 and, you know, I genuinely joined wanting to help people. It was really my sort of core motivation, I think. But, yeah, you definitely hit the ground running, sort of, and it was a very steep learning curve. And I think one of the first things I went to was some poor guy had hung himself.
Oh, gosh.
And as a 19-year-old, I kind of probably didn't understand the sort of, the deep complexities of that incident, and obviously now, so many years on, we know so much more, don't we, about mental health and and suicide. But yeah, that was one of the first things, and that was just sort of a fairly sort of ordinary kind of, you know, incident that we would go to. But yeah, that was one of my first sort of memories, really.
No, oh, wow, that's quite harsh, isn't it, really? That's quite an intense. And I suppose, like you said, you went on to the police because you wanted to change the grain, you wanted a different life, and you were sporty. And I suppose as a young person, you probably had an idea as to what you wanted, but what you experienced was something very different, wasn't it? And it's interesting you said, you know, you'd witnessed, that was the worst case scenario, you know, was witnessing a man that's been, you know, hung himself. But what was the best, I have to also look at the other side, what was the best experience that you had in the force?
Oh, I mean, lots of great experiences and a lot of fun, really. And you know, I think to a certain extent you do see the darker side of life, because that's just sort of the nature of a busy sort of, you know, area of London, and the things you sort of get called to, really. But you know, you just have to, you do have to keep your sense of humour.
Of course, no, totally keeps you going, doesn't it? I mean, naturally, as people, we always look at the negative biases, you know, that's natural, because we'd always, and it takes a lot more to look at the positive, and that's, so I find it interesting to look at both, really, to be honest. So yeah, just give me one story that was absolutely amazing that you know while you were in the Met. Was it just one story that stands out for you?
I mean, yeah, I mean I could tell you about the first sort of real sort of major trauma that happened to me that was very significant to me, and we'd automatically sort of label it as a bad incident. A lot of good has come from it. I could start to talk about that if you wanted, Tanya.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, no, totally. Because sometimes I always say within the trigger or within the darkness is what brings light a lot of the time, isn't it? Sometimes it's that experience that may appear bad that brings good, do you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we label them as bad, don't we? But they're not necessarily, they are. And yes, that was in the summer of 1991, and I'd got a young son, Ben, who was 10 months old, and I was just on patrol with a colleague of mine, and I was driving the van, and John was a passenger, and we got a call to, it was just a sort of everyday sort of call, really. Just somebody causing a disturbance in the shopping area of Wood Green in North London. So we went along, and we were joined by two other colleagues who were sort of just behind us, pulled up in the guy who we'd been given the description had crossed the road, and he was on the opposite pavement. Went to the people in the shop to see what had been going on, and I crossed the road and talked to our suspect, and to me, and he and I just asked him what he'd been doing, and he just instantly swung round, and the next thing I knew,
Sorry, Helen, I think because there's just been a bit of interference, but you said he just swung round you, and the next thing you knew.
yes, sorry, yes. The next thing I knew, he'd swung round, and he'd stabbed me in the stomach.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
Yeah, and he'd got the knife sticking out of his fist, so he was punching, but with the knife blade sticking out. I mean, this all happened so in the blink of an eye. You know, it just went from a normal day to this sort of chaotic scene of, and I didn't know.
And
Yeah, so
Helen,
I.
what do you remember? So when you got stats, when you said, gosh, you just said it like it was, wow, he stabbed you in the stomach. I know it's such a long time ago,
Yeah.
but what do you remember of that? It's, what do you remember of that actual moment?
Well, I just remember, because it really, the whole incident, I think, was over in about a couple of minutes, but so I kind of just remember this literally flying backwards through the air. It was before there was body armor, and feel it, a searing pain in my stomach.
Gosh, wow.
And I actually got back up off the floor and felt quite angry towards him, really, because I
Wow.
was sort of very fit and strong and sort of
Yeah.
capable, and I, yeah, sort of everything was flashing through my mind, and I got up back up off the floor, and I could see him, and he was stabbing my friend, my colleague.
Oh, gosh, wow. Wow.
Yeah,
Wow.
so I tried to stop him, and as I moved forward towards him again, he stabbed me twice more, and I ended back up off the floor, on the floor
Wow.
about 12 foot away. Yeah,
Wow.
and at that point I was totally sort of incapacitated on the floor, and just my white, I remember this feeling of terror coming over me, and my white shirt turned completely red. Yeah, and I'd never felt fear really like that. Well, I had never felt fear like that before.
Yeah, gosh.
Yeah, and he, to cut it slightly short, because we could probably talk for hours on this particular incident, but he stabbed four of us 10 times in about 90 seconds. So that's how fast it happened.
Wow. And it's
Yeah.
just amazing that you're here today. Did any of your colleagues pass away from that incident?
I mean, we were so incredibly lucky, because as I mentioned a few minutes ago, that there was no body armor. We were basically totally, you know, unarmed and sort of unprepared for that kind of level of violence, really.
Wow.
And we all survived. Yeah, we were all really lucky.
Just have to
Yeah,
breathe. I have to
very.
just breathe. That is just like, for me, it's wow. That's, do you mean to be stabbed 10 times and to survive? You kind of feel, gosh, you must, in some ways, it's a horrible incident, but someone up there is definitely probably looking after you to have, be able to come back from that. That's incredible. And so what happened? What happened next? What was, how was that kind of all dealt with?
Well, yeah, he sort of, I've been told, I wasn't aware of this, but he started to sort of calm down slightly. And John, who'd been my passenger, although he'd been stabbed in the stomach, he managed to get the knife off him. But with the help of an off-duty police officer who was out shopping with his wife.
Wow.
And he helped. Yeah. And I think, you know, they managed to get the knife off him and calm him down. And, you know, that was it. And we were all taken off to different hospitals and, you know, treated for our injuries. But yes, we were very lucky. But and a lot of good came from that incident. And John did a lot of work around body armour and protective equipment. And that eventually, a few years later, that was, you know, bought in as a result of our incident. So it kind of changed policing for the better, really.
That's incredible. Do you know what? It's so horrible. But like you said, when I asked you what was that the best memory for you, and you said actually it's not the same, it's trauma, but at the same time, from being stabbed 10 times, it's the action had to be taken. You know, what's for the armour and for the protection and, you know, everything else that was done for you to, for the police or for these things to be put in place. And I think that is incredible. It is so sad that you have to go through that for that to happen. But I suppose that's how life is, isn't it? That's how people, you know, that's how people start to see from people's other mistakes and things that have gone on. You start to see how we're going to fix this. What's the solution? How do we move forward? So that's absolutely incredible story, Helen. I don't know where to go next. I mean, I'm still a bit taken back by that. But even hearing you talk about this today, how does it make you feel in terms of looking back?
Yeah, I'm relatively comfortable being able to talk about the, you know, the incidents, because there's more to come. But I think it's still you know, obviously has that, you know, real sort of emotional connection, but you know, I'm relatively comfortable, and I guess I wouldn't be talking to you today if these things hadn't happened. So I do see them as something that it's sort of a tool that I can kind of use, hopefully that will help other people, really.
Yeah, no, totally. And it is, and so like you say, to have to have gone through what you've gone through, I'm really sorry. But like you say, the other side, the positive side of it is, you know, the body armor protection equipment was brought in and things have changed. But I'll still let you, because I know there's more to be said, so I'll let you continue with your story. I know you said you've got more to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I just had to breathe and take that in myself, because it's so much for me just hearing it. It's and obviously probably for the audience, that's a lot to take in. It's a lot to have gone through. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it was at a time when there were, you know, there wasn't any sort of awareness about mental health either. So, you know, yeah, we just literally just sort of recovered from our injuries and had a few bit of time off work and carried on. But, you know, I think in hindsight, I was definitely, you know, mentally traumatized by the whole thing. So I carried on working. I've got a young son and... which sort of leads me on to sort of a couple of years later, 1993, we had a call to that the bombs were going to go off, actually, again in Wood Green High Road, in exactly the same shopping area. Yeah. So we all rushed down to the shops. It was just before Christmas, so everybody's doing their Christmas shopping, and we just started trying to explain where the bombs were going to go off, but we knew that they would, because it was a recognised code word that had been given.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was just moving from shop to shop, shouting, you know, through the shop doorway to get out. There was a bomb going off, and I think actually a lot of people thought we were crazy. you know, they were just doing their Christmas shopping and
yeah
and I moved in sort of off the street through this covered walkway, and one of the bombs went off back out on the street where I'd been in a bin. And I found myself on the floor, and there was just glass flying everywhere, smoke and pigeons flying and alarms going off. And it just was a real surreal sort of situation, and everything sort of went into slow motion. And I wasn't physically hurt, thank goodness, and up off the floor and sort of thought, you know, sort of what was that?
Yeah,
wow. Yeah, really, again, really, really sort of frightened, because not knowing kind of which way to go, feeling quite vulnerable, really. Mm. So I went back out onto the street and met up with a colleague of mine, and we kind of looked at each other, and I think we exchanged a few words, you know, what's that? And we moved up the street, which is trying to get people sort of away. We didn't know this. We just moved away from a bin where we'd been stood, and that exploded, and there was a bomb in that bin. Gosh. And we were really lucky that they were fairly small devices, but they did a lot of damage to sort of, you know, the glass and shop fronts, but nobody was killed. I think a few people were hit by flying glass. I mean, I was physically, and injured, but it was just such a terrifying experience again. That's shops as best we could. And eventually I sort of lost track of time, really, but we eventually went back to the police station, and I had a bit of a debrief in a room, and sort of went home. But that was quite another significant sort of traumatic event.
Gosh, you know what, Helen? It's there's just so much trauma there, and it just makes you think, as you know, that role of, or taking that role of a police officer, and being in the area that you work, being in Wood Green. I think Wood Green right now is not that far from where I live. I don't really generally go that way, and we go the other way, to be honest with you. When I go out, I don't really go to Wood Green often, actually. I don't like the energy there for some reason, never have done.
Yeah.
And it's interesting now you're telling me this story, because probably now I know why I don't go that way. I always go the other if I'm going to go shopping. I never go shopping in Wood Green, and it's not that far from me. I'll probably go to the West End. But it's really interesting hearing all of these stories from the outside in, and all the trauma, because there is so much trauma within the Met. And as you said, only recently people have started to be more aware of regards to the mental health. But I mean, what do you think about it now? Because they do training, they do stuff, but do you think it's enough?
I mean, obviously it's something I feel really passionate about, and I still think there's so much more that could be done, and I haven't got all the answers. I'm not an expert. And I know a lot of it comes down to finances and things, but yeah, I still think there's an awful lot to be done. And it's just, and I guess that's my, you know, my heartfelt passion, that maybe the momentum's gaining with my story, that maybe I can somehow sort of help people. Because I think the military, from what I've seen, are sort of grasp the concept, and they're really running with it, and they're doing amazing things. And I just got this feeling, you know, it's particularly the police service, I don't know the other emergency service, but it's sort of falling behind. But again, I haven't got all the answers. Maybe somewhere in it I can make a little bit of a difference. That would be wonderful.
Well, I feel that you're making a difference right now just by telling your story, because there is a lot of people that are going through stuff. And I know that you did mention, I think you probably mentioned to my audience, that you actually had some counselling yourself and you worked with a charity. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that, in terms of the counselling that you received and the charity that helped you out to help you kind of cope with some of the trauma that you'd experienced?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, just briefly, I'll touch on that. Sort of, there was a third incident which leads me on to. Would that be all right?
Go for it.
Yeah. So I was the first mum in 1994 to join the Met's armed response vehicles, and so Boxing Day 1994, I was shot.
Oh gosh.
So. That was on top of all the other things. We were called to an incident where a guy had abducted his toddler in a pushchair from his girlfriend, and he'd got a gun. So we'd been called by the local police to back them up and try and sort of resolve the situation. So we were called as the armed response. And again, to cut it down sort of. As much as I can, he sort of came across us in a side street. We were forming up with a view to go in to sort of find him in the flat that we knew he was holed up in, but he came out looking for us, and we were just forming up in a side street, and he came into the street, and again, this happened all very, very quickly. He produced a gun from his coat, and as I saw drawing my weapon from its holster, and everybody else, my colleagues, were reacting to him. The gun went from his mouth and his outstretched arm, and he shot, and I was shot.
Oh gosh! Wow!
Yeah. And I instantly knew I'd been shot. It was like being hit by a truck, and I sort of collapsed on one knee, and he was shot by my colleagues, and it was just a pretty sort of violent situation that erupted sort of, again, in a blink of an eye. You know, you just literally have a split second to sort of... I think my whole body was sort of screaming to run in the opposite direction, but of course you don't, that's not your job. You sort of run towards it, but and that the shooting sort of ended my career. I think it was that sort of the mental sort of trauma. And that was my last day at work, was the day I was shot. And I was medically discharged about 18 months later with post-traumatic stress disorder, which wasn't really something people knew very much about so much back then. We didn't really talk about mental health or really have much knowledge of it. So that was sort of a big blow for me, really. So although it's sort of a long time ago, it's kind of very current, and which leads me on to sort of really come about to be sort of involved with the charity that you just mentioned a few minutes ago. Last May, I was involved in breaking the deadlifting world record for Rock to Recovery, which is a charity which helps mainly military veterans, but anybody who's the military, they will help. And we raised over £5,000 for them, and
wow.
Yes, which was a fantastic thing to be involved in, and it sort of led me on to discovering another charity called Hidden Valley Bushcraft, which I'm now involved in, and I went to their Woodland Warrior program, which is based in an ex-marine who had a lot of trauma, and sort of to help himself he bought this woodland, and then it sort of involved, he realized he could help other people, and it's just been life-changing, really, going there for that weekend. And they help military veterans, first responders, and they've also got funding for key workers now, and it's just an amazing place. And they encouraged me to do podcasts and start public speaking and to tell my story, really. You know, it was direct result of going there, you know, that I started speaking. I just hadn't spoken about it for all those years.
You know what, Helen, I just want to say thank you for sharing the space with me and for telling me your story. And as I'm listening to you now and I'm reflecting, I'm just looking at the years like 1991, 1993, and then 1994. And when you said to me, you know, you resigned, in my mind, I thought, of course you've resigned, you know, of course. I mean, I don't understand how you didn't resign in 1991. if we look at it, because it's like, wow, you know. But, you know, I always talk about resilience myself. It's something that I look at, you know, I look around me and there's so many people that I know are so resilient, and everybody goes through their own stuff and everybody's experience is unique. But I must say, just listening to you today, I've never met anyone that's experienced this in terms of the physical, in terms of the, you know, this mental, psychological and physical trauma. You've experienced so much and probably the most horrific story that I've had on Real Stories today. And I just take my hat off for you to actually share the space with me and to actually trust me to take you on this journey. Because it is about trust, isn't it, for you to speak out? Because it takes a lot of work within that throat chakra to talk openly about something that must have been so traumatic and so painful. It's almost like some of these people have attacked you really because you've been in this kind of police outfit, you know, and some people have probably thought, you know, this is my way out, or for whatever reason they've done what they've done. You have been a victim of that. And that is what's so disturbing. And I suppose, you know, what's really interesting, we always hear about other people's stories, but it's not often that I have a police officer on here talking about what they've experienced, you know. And as I know you, I know of you, Helen, you just have such a gentle, calm energy. And as you said, you were sporty, but you just, for me, I'm just listening and I'm thinking, gosh, you are so powerful, you know, your energy is so powerful. And to be here today and to be working with, you know, Rock to Recovery and Hidden Valley Bushcraft, it's, you know what, I just think it's beautiful that you're able to do that. And it's beautiful that you have the charities, that there are those charities out there that can help people like yourself. And also now you're speaking out, now you're doing, you're a mental health advocate. I think the power of a story is so powerful that it will help people, and it will help people going through stuff. And I think there does need to be a little bit more in the Met with regards to recovery. A little bit more money spent on these sort of things, because I do know there's a huge absentee problem within the Met as well. So people go on long-term absenteeism to deal with the trauma and everything else that they go through. And some people don't come back as strong. So I just want to say that to you. I just want to say thank you for that.
Oh, thanks, Tanya. I'm quite touched by your comments. It's really, yeah, it means a lot. And it's funny, isn't it? I joined wanting to help people, and sort of all those things, I've come sort of full circle. And I just hope that, you know, from what I've gone through, you know, it's somehow helped somebody. We all go through stuff, don't we? You know, that's the thing. We all have things that you know, come along and knock us for six in our lives. And about sort of getting the right people around you and sort of doing the right things and, you know, coming through them and realising you can come through them, I think.
Yes, yes. And also what I thought was so beautiful about your experience was it's so horrific and so traumatic, but you're able to look at it as light. Like when you said, you know, but this is a good story, because when you said when you got stabbed 10 times, then the body armor, you were looking at what had come out from it, you know. And most people would look at that story and think, oh my God, she got stabbed 10 times. That's so horrific. And you know, that what counseling have you gone through? And I'm sure you had all of that as well. But you looked at it as if you know, net, because of that, they brought in the body armor protection equipment. You know, you were looking at, that's such a police thing to do, or such a caring thing to do, you know, in terms of, well, this is now going to help other people, so other people don't have to go through it. And that's real activist kind of behavior, really. You know, you've pushed forward, you've suffered, and you've taken so much, and for other people to now, you know, have that equipment. And then in 1993, when you talked about the bombs going off, I was thinking, this sounds like a movie. This sounds like I'm watching a movie when you said the glass goes up. And I always find it really interesting in movies, just to share this with you, when the glass goes flying and you saw the pigeons fly off as the bomb went off. Because always when you see movies and you watch the movies and people jump through glass, and then they still look amazing. I thought, that's why I can't watch these movies. You can jump through glass and then still look like, you know, Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible comes out after jumping through glass and do, still looks handsome. And you know, so that's how you know it's a movie, don't you? Because people do that all the time. I always find that fascinating when you watch those action movies, you know. And then when you're talking about it, you go, shit, this is not a movie, this is real. You've really experienced this. And then the other thing I started thinking on was, I don't know, recently I've been watching Homecoming, because I don't watch a lot of movies or TV, but, you know, since it's lockdown, I have watched a little bit of, what do you call it, series. And I started watching Homecoming with Julia Roberts, and I think recently it was Janelle Monáe was in it. And they're veterans who go into this scheme, and it's all fake because they're basically drugging them to let them go back into the military. And I just thought that is, after watching it, I had to just go and have a cup of tea and say, my God, this is the most horriblest thing, how they can drug them to forget everything they do and then send them back into the military. And that's just a movie. But I just feel like we're through movies and television sometimes. There's a lot of truth in it, isn't there?
Very thought-provoking,
in terms of what people do. So I mean, my last question to you is, what do you do for escapism? What do you do for now, you know, being, you're out of it now, you've done work with Rock to Recovery and Hidden Valley Bushcraft, but what do you do for that escapism, for that feel good? What makes you feel good now? What do you do now?
Yeah, I think my sort of go-to coping mechanism all along has been sort of physical activity, keeping fit. So, you know, look, I love being out in nature, and I used to run a lot. I walk more now, but, you know, weights, anything sort of physical just helps my mental health as well as obviously my physical health. And I really try and look after my diet as well, and do yoga and a bit of mindfulness, all those kind of things I try and bring together, just, you know, that they all make me feel better and you know, important to me.
That's so beautiful. And I was thinking that, because I feel like mindfulness is just so powerful, isn't it? And everything that you've gone through, it's like, of course you need mindfulness. And the other side of the mindfulness, you said you're quite fit, and the weights, because I know I like doing weights as well, and you get a really good feeling when you do weights, don't you? And especially when you've got that busy mind as well, it really helps you to just channel the energy in a different way, isn't it? So you're channeling that energy in a different way, and because your body can do it, you're pushing your body to another level, aren't you, when you're doing weights? You're pushing and it hurts. It does hurt.
definitely it does. And it's kind of like I think it's like a bit of a form of meditation in a way, because it takes you out of your thinking brain and you're just in that moment of physical pain or whatever it is. But yeah, because I mean, we all have days when you know, we get that negative chatter in our heads, and you know, I do, and it really is my kind of go-to sort of coping strategy, really, that I really do rely on.
Oh, and I think it's great. And I think it's great that you've got that coping mechanism, and that you're doing that, and that you're, you know, sharing your story with the world now, and that you're helping other people. I just want to thank you for coming on the show today. I'm going to just bring it to a close now, because it is such a, we've gone a little bit over, a little bit longer story, but I feel we needed to, because there's just so much there and you had so much to share. But I just want to say thank you for coming on my show. And from Tanya, the communication doctor, and Helen Barnett, adios.
Wow. This is really hard for me, actually, because it's so much information here. But one of my takeaways from this show is resilience. 1991, she was stabbed 10 times, brought in the body armour protection equipment. 1993, witnessing bombs going off. 1994, shot. It took those three major occasions for Helen to resign and then go through this process with her PTSD. Well, of course, it makes sense. And I just feel that she's incredibly brave. And I take away from her her braveness, her resilience, her courage, and the need for a better world. And also the whole approach to wanting to help other people and using her experience, which wasn't nice, to now help others with Rock to Recovery and Hidden Valley. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit our website at communicationdoctor.co.uk. To listen to more real stories, don't forget to subscribe.